Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 52 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
My name is Billy Cox, and I'm a play bass guitar and well known for playing with a lot of R&B artists, mainly play bass with Jimi Hendrix at the Jimi Hendrix Experience and the Band of Gypsies.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story of the work you've done and the music you've created over the years. It sort of told the story of how you met Jimmy in the Army, but I'm curious about taking a few steps back further and trying to understand when you first discovered the bass and what you loved about it.
This kind of takes me back. My first instrument was a violin. My father wanted me to play a violin, and I didn't necessarily want to play the violin. Basically, we'll take even further back. I came from a musical family. My mother was a concert pianist. And in the household, I heard a lot of Beethoven, Liszt, Tchaikovsky, Gershwin. And she was a great pianist. And a lot of times I just would go in when she was playing or practicing, just sit around and listen to that. Then she heard my two uncles, Uncle Norman and Uncle Lawrence, one played trumpet, one played saxophone. And they had a little light combo. They would play. They wouldn't let me come to the little the joints that they played at. This was all in Wheeling, West Virginia. So and then my father taught me how to play a harmonica. So I was around music all of my life. I went from the violin to the piano. Unfortunately, we didn't have a piano after my mother separated from my father. They got a divorce. And then the new household, we didn't have a piano there at all. So I had auntie that used to come by, pick me up and take me over to her house. And she taught me how to basically navigate, but she didn't. She expected me to find a place to rehearse and play, but I never did. I had a uncle that, a godfather rather, that had a piano at his house, but they were a little old fashioned for me. So that kind of petered out. And then in school, wound up playing trumpet and was a pretty good trumpet player. Then when we moved from Wheeling, West Virginia, we moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At that time, I was in high school. Played trumpet in the marching band. And something happened. I wound up playing a baritone horn. My armature for that, you have to have a particular armature when you play. My reading was good, but my armature was kind of a little sluggish there. So I went to the baritone horn and got pretty good at it. It was in the F clef. And so I got pretty fair at that. And then one day, I was playing baseball, and I was just turning in my equipment into my locker, and all of a sudden, there was a place in Pittsburgh called the Syria Mosque, where they had concerts. It was late in the evening, wasn't quite dark, but they were having what they call a little cabaret down there, and I heard this band playing, and there was an instrument that was resounding through the universe that was my destiny. It was the first electric bass I'd ever heard. So I had one of my buddies to take, I said, put this in my locker, man. I gotta go. And I ran down to Syria Mosque, which was about two blocks away from my high school. And I waited outside right where I could see from the back door that the band was playing. And I got, when they took their break, I got introduced to my first electric bass, and I was hooked from that day on.
What year was that?
1958.
And so you get hooked on the instrument. When do you first get your hands on one? What kind of bass was it? What were you trying to do with it when you first got it?
It was in a pawn shop. And that summer, well, that band happened to be Lloyd Price's band. I think that song that I heard resounding was Personality. That was a big hit for him at that particular time. So the next time I got my hands on one of those was in a pawn shop. I laid it away, but never could get enough money to, you know, get it out. And so the fellow, was down the street. He had a, I think it was a Silvertone. I used to go down there and play with it. And that was it. You know, I didn't really want to really just, you know, I didn't have the get up and go to really get one. So what I did, I kind of got into the high school symphony. And I told a lie. I said I was an upright player, but I could finagle around. So I had to do a lot of study, but we couldn't take those bases home. They were too big, and I lived about a mile away from school. So I did the best I could, but I used to get the band director used to get kind of teed off because I played like to do the pizzicato playing with the fingers. And they wanted a lot of playing with the bow, and I wasn't all that good. So I gave it up. That was the end of that. But I knew deep down inside that was the instrument for me. Well, fast forward 2 years later, I'm in the military at Fort Campbell. We all went to a theater, and some of us, and when we got out, it was raining, so we all were running for cover. I wound up on the doorstep of Service Club Number 1, which is in the main post, and at which time I heard some playing coming from the window where I was standing by, and I turned to the guy next to me. I said, "You know, that's pretty unique, the guitar playing in there." He says, man, it sounds like a bunch of mess to me. I went in, introduced myself. The guy looked up at me. He said, "My name's Jimmy Hendricks. What's yours?" I said, "Billy Cox." I said, "I used to fiddle around with the bass." He said, "Well, they got these electric basses in here. You can just turn in your service car and they get, you know, get an amp and a bass, and we can jam." So we did. And that was history.
So that's an amazing story, because if you consider that you were sort of playing the bass, not really. And I guess at that point, Jimmy, where was Jimmy at in terms of his playing? Was this sort of him learning? Was he fairly mature at that point? Like, how would you grade him now looking back?
From what to what?
How just in terms of what? Like, if you hear him playing at the service club and you go, "Hey, we should jam together." Is he at the point where he's really mastered the instrument, or is he still tinkering around with figuring out what it was?
Well, he had already figured out what it was. He was trying to figure out where to go and what to do. He basically could play. It was in his infancy, I would probably say that. He knew about maybe how to play in maybe two or three keys, and not that good. But what struck me was the way he attacked the strings, and what he was attempting to do, and the mistakes he was making weren't that bad. So after we started jamming, we started jamming on some songs of that, you know, the stuff, Muddy Waters, Lightnin' Hopkins, and basically blues songs and songs of that day. And Lloyd Price had a song out called Soul Twist, where we really jammed on, you know, I was little.
When Jimmy was playing like that, and you can appreciate the way he was approaching the instrument, did that change how you were approaching bass? Like, did that influence, because at that time, I'm also assuming that you weren't surrounded by other bass players, there wasn't this thing. So was his style impacting how you were thinking about playing the bass, or were you thinking about the bass as more supportive in the traditional sense of what the bass was?
Right. The bass was a supportive instrument at that point in time. And actually, it didn't really come into a solo instrument probably until about 20 years later. But however, we learned the songs of that day and time, and then we hired a drummer. In fact, the drummers, me and him, have been reunited through the media. He lives in Florida now, and we played around at least could maneuver ourselves around the songs of that day and time. And so I was a business manager, so we played at the service clubs and the EM club, then some private parties and things of that nature. And we were doing pretty good. But we were still in the learning phase, and I knew that we needed a lot of rehearsing and theory and et cetera. So I was in the 101st Airborne, and so was Jimmy. But Jimmy was more tunnel visioned into trying to learn the guitar. He wasn't that good of a soldier. So there was a fellow who worked at Service Club Number 2, where we would go in some of the rooms there and practice. He had about a month and a half left, and he was fixing to get discharged. And I told him, I said, Ron, I said, I like the job you got. You come in, how do you come in early in the morning? He said, I'm here at 8 o'clock. They send me a work detail about 9, and there through about 11 to go to lunch. And then I stay here till the ladies from USO come in about 2 or 3 o'clock, and then I'm off. I'm my own boss, and I'm in a group called Special Services. I said, how would I go about getting your job when you got discharged? He said, well, there's a major who was the head of the Special Service Division. You got to talk to him, but I don't think you could get in get this job because you're a Screaming Eagle. And this is the Third Army, so I don't know if you could work that out. He said, but you can work it out. You go talk to him. I went and talked to the major, and he told me the same identical thing. Well, Specialist Cox said, do you like that job? I don't see where you possibly could even get it because you're in the 101st. I said, well, what if I terminate? He said, you're willing to terminate and give up 50. At that time, you get $56 per month for a jump. You had to do at least one jump a month to stay in good standing. So I told him, I said, well, would you hold it open for me? He said, I can't hold it open for you, but if you want to terminate, just, let me know. I said, well, I want to terminate. So with that in mind, I left and I talked to a guy in my company, and he said, well, man, he said, I can probably get your orders. He talked to another sergeant who wrote up their orders. I told my company commander and all, I said, look, I want to terminate because I've got some other things I really want. He said, well, he said, you can get it worked out. You can get it worked out. So I talked to the sergeant that talked to the guy who typed the order. So he says you give him $50 and 2 fifths of Canadian Club, and he might work it out. So I gave him $50, 2 fifths of Canadian Club. Lo and behold, the papers came through. I don't know how it worked out. I wound up at replacement detachment. Left my outfit, and it was kind of spooky because at that time, Vietnam was just beginning to keep a lot. Some noise was going on in Vietnam. So in the morning, first morning I got there, the next day they called me all of us out front. They, Jones, Korea, Thompson and West, Vietnam. So that's all we got for the day. That went on for about 3 or 4 days. And on the fifth day, said Cox, Special Services. So I got the job. I was three blocks away from it. And so it afforded, after Jimmy did his formation in the morning, he was like you call a ghost. And he'd practice, he'd had his guitar, he never had a case for his guitar. He'd walk down, and day after day after day, we rehearsed all day long until it was time for me. So we got pretty good. I learned from him. We learned from each other. We wrote songs. One thing about what we did, I think, that was pretty unique. We came up with these riffs and these intricate patterns that we created. And one day he looked at me, he says, if anybody knew we were playing music like this, they'd lock us up. I'd say, yeah, it's pretty unique. Ultimately, it was songs that we would wound up putting in Dolly Dagger, In From the Storm, songs of that nature. So later on, we we got discharged. I think he got discharged. We got a job working in the evening at a place called the Pink Poodle in Clarksville, Tennessee, which is about 25, 30 miles from the post. And we rented a little place in the little house up there. Our little girlfriends and us, we just, you know, but I still was in the military because he had got discharged a month before I did. But I was preparing to be discharged also. So finally, I bought a little 55 Plymouth. And that got us back and forth instead of bumming rides like we were. And we became the house band for good, for real, at the Pink Poodle. Well, after about a year there, we knew that we were trying to broaden our horizons and wound up in Indianapolis, Indiana, where there were a lot of musicians. That was the home of Wes Montgomery and a lot of other famous musicians. And of course it didn't pan out because the guy who told us to come there, he didn't work at the club at all. He told us that he would sit in, but we thought we had a regular job. And so we got stranded there. And then finally our girlfriends came and they knew if something was up. We had called them on the phone, and my distributor had gone out on my car. It was really old. And finally we wound up back in Clarksville at the Pink Poodle. And after about 6 or 7 months, these guys from here in Nashville, Tennessee, said they had a club. They wanted us. They heard we were probably the best band east of the mighty Mississippi. We laughed at that. And they wanted us to audition for the job here. So we did come, audition, and they wanted us to play. They thought we were good. And that's how I wound up in Nashville.
And so when you think back on Jimmy's life, it's hard to imagine that he was 27 when he passed. It's like almost mind-blowing. When I was getting ready for our conversation, Billy, and just reading more about Jimmy, and I had forgotten how young he was and the impact his music made and how he really thought differently about music and how you guys created music together. And I'm wondering, now being at the age you're at and the life you've led and how you've kept the music alive for so many decades, how do you reflect back on someone that talented who's gone so soon for the reasons he passed?
Jimi Hendrix was a unique individual. A lot of people really didn't understand him thoroughly, the type of a person that he was. He was a very spiritual person. And you might want to call him a cosmic messenger, because a lot of times he baffled me with a lot of things he said and a lot of things he talked about. And he knew where he wanted to go. And what he wanted to do musically. He saw music as a means to kind of bring people together. He was kind of global before the rest of the world became global. And he saw music as being uplifting for people. And being spiritual like he was, and you got to realize that spiritual multiplies and never divides. And he was very, very unique in all that he did, and he had a purpose for what he did musically.
When you think about the work that you did, it's an interesting story that he goes to London. You can't afford to go. But he doesn't forget you. There's sort of this story that you've told where he says, you know, I'm gonna come back for you. Let me go do my thing and I'm gonna come back for you. And I mean, again, his career was so short that in 1969, Noel Redding leaves the band and you guys reconnect. You go on to play with him at probably one of the life-changing events of all time for music and maybe even culture, being Woodstock. What happens in that time? Like, how do you hear that Noel is gone? Do you have a relationship with him? When Jimmy reaches out to you, what's the ask? Is it, hey, like, I'm back for you? Or were you like, well, but you were playing with this guy, Noel. Like, what's going on? Like, what was that moment like for you?
Well, I didn't know about all of that. All I knew was when he left, well, we had formed this band here called the King Casuals. And Jimmy knew about that his destiny was not in Nashville. He learned. He always stated that it was in Nashville where I really learned to play. But he knew he had to move on to bigger and better things. So eventually, he talked to the MC with Gorgeous. His name was Gorgeous George. He was with Jackie Wilson. He said, Billy, you need to come down to Jackie Wilson. The bus is down there. I talked to this MC. We might be able to go on the road. So I went and we went down that night, heard the show, talked to the MC. But I didn't hear coming from the MC's mouth what I wanted to hear. So we went back to, as we were going back to, after the concert, I said, Jimmy, I don't think you need even. You know, he didn't give anything concrete, and you know, we need more knowledge about what he's able to do, what he can do. You don't want to just go out on the road and be stranded. He said, "Well, man, I gotta go." So he left and went on back down there, got his little clothes and at the place, and went back down there. And I said, "Okay." And about maybe 3 weeks later, he's calling me, man. I'm stranded in St. Louis. Okay, he made moves like this for maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times. By that time, I'm got another guitar player. His name's Johnny Jones. So Jimmy's just out doing this thing, and 2 or 3 times I had to get him back. He had to come back to Nashville. He couldn't reach out to nobody else. And I always, you know, he was my bud, and I looked out for him. And so I hired Johnny with Jimmy in mind. Like, well, now Jimmy might have to come back and play for a couple of weeks to try to get himself together and move on. He says, okay, we'll do that. He adapted the name of the King Casuals, and we went on to do some other work with a show here called Night Train and another one called The Beat in Dallas-Fort Worth. And we're moving right along. And then after that, I made a little money, and we were doing a lot of sessions here in Nashville. Moved real well. I had a publishing company up on Music Row, and where I produced a lot of R&B artists and work deals and worked for Hoss Allen, John Richburg. And the only telephone number he had was the one that was next door at the time when I was living on Jefferson Street to call. So one day, Mr. Wright came over to where I was. He owned Wright's Radio and Television Shop. He said, someone's called and said, Jimmy's going to be in Memphis, next week, so, you know, he wanted to see you. I go to Memphis. I see Jimmy. And after the gig's over, we're talking. And his main thing was, things weren't working out too well with the bass player. And he wondered if I could just, you know, get away where we can put together some things. And he had been putting out some records and stuff that he said that he has depleted a lot of his ideas. And you can't, you know, and he said, you just can't take creativity and push things on. You have to take time for creation to grow. And so they were pushing him to put out more records and do more things. And so I thought about, did a lot of thinking about that. I didn't know if I wanted to go to New York or not, because I was doing all right, and I didn't really want to give up what I was doing. So what I couldn't sell, I gave away, and I wound up in New York. If, you know, in hindsight, which is 2020, if I had to do it again, I probably would have got on the next thing smoking back to Nashville. But however, I wound up in New York, And he was under a lot of pressure. So I said, look, don't worry about the pressure. Let's have fun. You know, I'm here now. We can still go back. And so with that in mind, we had a lot of fun. We wrote a lot of songs. We did the Woodstock thing, worked out. And he wanted to add to the band. The same reason that I didn't want to go, because I didn't, when they first called me to go, I didn't really want to go because I knew that he was going to be up against a lot of negatives. And if he had me, it was going to be even be worse. Because I heard a lot about England at that date and time. But however, we did all the stuff that we had to do. I played on, you know, the studio itself was not, it was kind of like a since music was our hobby and our job, we enjoyed the creativity in the studio. And a lot of times say, well, you're spending too much time in the studio. Costs are astronomical and you guys are going to have to, but we just kept on pushing. Ultimately, they were able to put out The Crowd Love, Rainbow Bridge, War Heroes, Hendrix in the Way. We were very successful with recording a lot of things that ultimately came out and still in the can to produce.
So you sort of glossed over it a little bit, but it's a huge thing. Your first live gig with Jimmy is essentially Woodstock, correct?
Not live, no. First concert like that. We played in little clubs down in Greenwich Village and some things in Harlem, things of that nature that we did. But the first big paying gig was Woodstock.
So let's talk about Woodstock. It's part of the reason we got connected. It's the 50th anniversary. It's the Summer of Love back then. There's this sort of hopefully changing of how we see people, each other, gender, race. We look back and we sort of lament this amazing moment in time. And I'm curious, for someone like you who's on the road to Woodstock with Jimmy, what was the sentiment at the time? What was the feeling? What were you feeling as a band in terms of this moment? Or was it just, this seems like a big gig and we'll check it out?
The times were different than they are today. They had the Love Children, Flower Children, peace movement. And we lived like there was no tomorrow. When I say we, the culture itself. It was a great time. Jimmy had, in his mind, had a lot of plans that he wanted to fulfill. The Sky Church plan, the Electric Church. And he had planned on a full manifestation of Sky Church and Electric Church sound, which was really unfinished. And we looked forward to doing some great things. However, I feel in my mind that there were people and elements that did not want this thing to happen or to be, because they had their own agenda. And that were those who were his managers. He was happy, but they weren't happy. So, you know, got to remember the golden rule. He who has the gold rules.
Yeah.
So it just didn't work out too well.
So Jimmy passes in 1970. Where are you? How do you hear about this? And what's your reaction, considering that I'm sure at the time, as a bass player and musician and supporting friend, you thought, you know, twofold is, one, you lose a friend, and that's a massive tragedy. And on the other side, too, you're probably thinking about your work and your life and your music. And it seems that that period seems somewhat cut short for you as well.
Yes, it was. where it was. However, we had, and you got to remember also, not only did I was a part of the experience then, there was a factor of a lawsuit. And so we formed a group called the Band of Gypsies to get him free of that millions of dollars lawsuit. The other band didn't feel like they wanted to be a part of that. And so I agreed to help him, and Buddy Miles agreed to help him. And we went into that deal with a friendship and we felt as though we could do something to be to alleviate Jimmy of this worry that he had over his head. And we did. The Band of Gypsies concert, we did two concerts, New Year's Eve and two concerts New Year's Day. That was in 1970. And it was very, very successful. It was a four concerts, recorded, and Jimmy, as we were after the first concert, we were walking back to the dressing room, he said, "It's going to be all right now." Because Buddy had given 150%, Jimmy gave 200%, and I gave 150%. And that group was very dynamic, I must say so. And then soon after that, he had obligations as I had really came home and I'd had enough. I was tired and I wanted to stay home. But he called and said, "Man, we got to do some, got some gigs up." I said, "Well, I just don't necessarily want to worry about the gigs, Jimmy. I'm going to go my own way." Next thing you know, I've got him and the manager on the phone trying to get me back. So I go back and we went to Europe, had a little fun for a while, but in hindsight I should have stayed home because some intuitively something inside said stay home. But and so I got my nerves just couldn't take anymore, and so I when I did come home, I came home very ill. My father had to put me in the hospital.
And how long did that last?
How long did what last?
You being in the hospital and that?
Oh, maybe a couple of weeks. I mean, you know, I went to the hospital to get treatment. I tried to get well. You know, when your nerves give out on you, that's one of those things of life.
And when do you hear about Jimmy passing?
Jimmy called me about when I went home. First, when I went home, I was home for about maybe 2 or 3 days. And on that third day, he had called and said, asked me, could I get to the studio on Friday? I think I left there for Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I, could I get to the studio Friday? And I said, I'll try. And I really, in my mind, I really wanted to do it. But then, and 2 days later, he had passed. And that, I was even in worse shape. And that's how that wound up.
Now, what's amazing about the story is you then spend time playing with some amazing people, from Sam Cooke and Lou Rawls to Etta James and Little Richard. You did your own work. But really, this sort of you carrying on the music of Jimmy and the music you created together as a band has really been a, I would call it a pillar of your work and your passion, I'm guessing, and your playing too. I mean, here we sit now in 2019, and we've got this Experience Hendrix thing that's a phenomenal mix of players and people who are just dedicated to helping that music live on. How do you reflect on your life post Jimmy's passing and even up till now, these sort of decades that have gone on? Do you look back with a real love for the fact that you've sort of reattached yourself to that music? Do you wish to a certain part that maybe you sort of had just let it go and not done this sort of Experience Hendrix thing? How do you see it?
I see it as a part of musical history that I was a part of. a lot of those riffs and a lot of songs that we put together was some riffs out of my head. A lot of them were riffs out of Jimmy's head that we combined. So I definitely felt a part of the music. I am glad that when Jimmy passed, a lot of people were under the opinion that Jimmy died of a drug overdose or whatever. He said, but there are conflicting stories about how he passed. And for a long time, he was just a dead musician that died of a drug overdose. And no one would even venture to touch that. And Quiet as Kept, I formed a group and we just tried to play some of the music of that day and time and some of the music I was a part of. And my wife, who I'm married to today, still married to Brenda, was very instrumental in having me to get this group together to do some of this stuff. And one thing I give Jimmy credit for, he was an excellent musician. Excellent musician. And then when you were stating about the Sam Cooke, the Eddie James, all that was happening on a show that I played on called The Beat.
Yeah.
In Dallas, Texas. Then at the time, that was with Eddie James and Little Milton and Joe Tex and a lot of those. But the Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson was at the time when Jimmy was with us in here in Nashville.
Right.
But I had in my history, I just tried to clear up some of the negatives that have been floating out about Jimmy. I think it's really unnecessary to bash a great creative giant like Jimi Hendrix was. And then he was my friend, too.
And tell me a little bit about how you see the bass as an instrument. I mean, playing from the age that you did in the year that you did to us being here, the evolution of this instrument has been phenomenal in terms of the players and the respect it's received. You're very well lauded by bass players as being one of the sort of legends and Hall of Famers as a player. How do you approach the instrument? How do you see the instrument now in your current state and how you want to play it and approach it?
The bass, electric bass instrument now is a solo instrument that is accepted. At one point in time, they never, ever would let me get out and do a solo. And so now it has evolved as a front runner of instruments like the saxophone, trumpet, trombone, et cetera, and the guitar. So the bass itself has made great strides in 30 years, and I'm glad that I was a part of that evolution.
When you think about how you sort of cut your teeth as a player, and I've heard you talk about the Chitlin circuit quite a bit, was that a big part of what made you the player that you are in terms of that sort of both the circuit, the type of music that was being played, the styles that you heard? Because whenever I think of you and your playing, I'm always like, there's R&B, there's rock and roll, there's gospel, there's blues. It's like you transcend the genres and the music does too.
Yes. I myself, after I settled in here in Nashville, I became a player for Excello Records that had Brother Joe May, Sister Edna Galva Cook, the Brooklyn All-Stars, Shirley Caesar. And we played on all of those sessions for Ernie Young, who was the owner of the Excello Records here in town. And that was where a lot of the gospel was cut in. There's maybe 20 or 30 other artists. I just, you know, kind of, it eludes me, my memory right now. But we had a great time with that. And that, but, you know, you stop and you look at R&B and blues, it all emanated and came from gospel itself. Gospel was the first music that we all learned in church. And then we just put a 4/4 beat to it. Made it move a little bit, and then 1/4, 5 changes, and there you are. You got your blues, and it all worked out well together.
And when you think about what your days are like now, I mean, I was looking at the dates for Experience Hendrix. Do you look forward to those dates, that type of touring? Are you looking more to sort of take time away from music? Do you feel more active in music? How do you perceive bass playing for you in the moment of right now?
Experience Hendrix tours are great. They're great. The audiences that we see on those tours, they're very enthusiastic. They don't get enough. They're very appreciative of the music that we play. And I appreciate being able to go back and play some of those songs that I was a part of and helped to create.
And that's good enough for you?
Yeah.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time, Billy. It's a super interesting conversation to hear you go back in time, to hear your thoughts on Woodstock. And just, I'd love to sort of finish up with just having some thoughts on it being the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, you living in Nashville. You know, it feels like our world is changing very dramatically, both in a good way because of how the world can be connected, but also in a bad way because of how I think politics and sort of sides have taken fold. I mean, it is a moment in time that people are reflecting on Woodstock. What are your thoughts and where things are at today and what you'd like to have happen?
I think it's great to have a resurgence of Woodstock with the theme of love.
I think that's beautiful, man. Thank you so much for your time, Billy. It was a true pleasure.
All right. Thank you.